And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. As always, the second hour will be starting out with an LGBT news magazine called This Way Out. That'll be followed by more shorter segments like Radio Spin, Peak Oil Check-In, and Corporate Watchdog Radio, to name a few. So let's get right back into the rest of this week's show. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening.
No, I'm not waiting around while you have all the fun. Now, come on. Are you going to just stand there all day?
The law has changed so that we have gender equality in marriage under the law. And I think that makes a lot of people think that the problems have been solved when, of course, they haven't been.
I am overwhelmed by violent fantasies. I have spent hours thinking about things that I would like to do to Dick Cheney.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Dubai and Kuwait crack down on girly boys. A law professor exposes marriage equality's legal loopholes. And humorous Kate Clinton goes Cheney hunting. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Erica Springer.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 19, 2008. Police in the Gulf City state of Dubai, one of the seven oil-rich United Arab Emirates, arrested up to 40 men this week, various reports differ on the number, in a crackdown on cross-dressers in shopping malls and other public places. All of the men are non-resident workers or tourists, according to a statement by Dubai Police Chief Lieutenant General Dahai Khalfan Tamim on his organization's website. Dahai reported that administrative deportation orders would be sought against all of them. He denounced a campaign in May under the slogan, "Our social values are precious, let's protect them," targeting those who do not respect social values and behave like the opposite sex. A comparable campaign was announced in similarly Muslim Kuwait in June, specifically targeting gay men in addition to cross-dressers. A Kuwaiti MP told a local newspaper that the government has to crack down on what he called girly boys, who he claimed promote crime and sexual immorality in the country. Kuwait's parliament passed a law in December that makes imitating the appearance of the opposite sex a crime punishable by up to 1 year behind bars. Subsequent roundups netted at least 16 suspects, according to Human Rights Watch, which reported that three detainees were beaten.
But the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe plans to issue a formal declaration in support of a wide range of sexual orientation and gender identity rights, and to engage the entire organization in combating discrimination against LGBT people. European Union anti-bias protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity now only cover employment. The committee is composed of 27 foreign ministers of the Council of Europe's member nations. However, the proposals must receive unanimous support in order to be enacted. Boris Dietrich, advocacy director of the LGBT rights program at Human Rights Watch, said that the European Union's Charter of Fundamental Rights prohibits any discrimination on any grounds, including sexual orientation. It is past time to turn that promise into real protections.
The U.S. Senate voted this week to repeal a 21-year-old law barring HIV-positive people from visiting or seeking legal residency in the country. The measure was attached to a spending bill that triples amounts for programs that treat and protect millions in Africa and elsewhere from HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. The Senate version will have to be worked out with the House, which passed its version of the bill in April. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Joseph Biden of Delaware told reporters that he'd been coordinating with House leaders on the legislation and was confident of approval of a reconciled version sometime soon that includes repeal of the ban. It originated in 1987 and was explicitly codified by Congress in 1993 when it reformed U.S. immigration laws. While they currently exclude foreigners with any communicable disease of public health significance from entering the U.S., only HIV is specifically named in the statute. Rachel B. Tiven, executive director of the U.S. LGBT advocacy group Immigration Equality, called the ban ineffective, unnecessary, and simply bad public health policy, adding that it is especially harmful to gay and lesbian families who do not benefit from the waiver available to opposite-sex couples. The Senate's change is welcome and long overdue.
There were marriage equality developments in three U.S. states this week. As expected, the California Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to the legality of Proposition 8, a November ballot initiative that would nullify the court's May 15th ruling and constitutionally ban same-gender marriage. Thousands of same-gender couples have gotten marriage licenses, and many have already married in the state since the court ruling took effect in mid-June. A new field poll released this week suggested that Proposition 8 will fail, if only by a bare majority. 51% opposed the measure, while 42% said they'd vote for it. 63% of respondents identifying themselves as Democrats were against Proposition 8, and 66% of independents were opposed to it, but 68% of Republicans supported the proposed ban. The well-respected field poll surveyed 672 likely California voters during the week of July 8th through 14th. It had a sampling error of plus or minus 3.9 percentage points. Poll director Mark DiCamillo told reporters that starting out behind is usually an ominous sign for a proposition. Over 90% of propositions that start out behind get taken down. Marriage equality advocates say they're heartened by the poll results, but note that the November 4th vote is still months away and that opponents of Proposition 8 must continue to fundraise and organize against it.
About 200 LGBT activists and union members gathered in front of the Manchester Grand Hyatt in San Diego this week to launch a boycott of the hotel. Its owner, prominent local businessman Doug Manchester, donated $125,000 to the campaign in support of Proposition 8. About a half a block away, nearly 100 who favor the proposed amendment staged a counter-demonstration.
Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reported that dozens of United Methodist Church ministers in California are defying church rules and performing wedding ceremonies for same-gender couples, even though they could be defrocked for doing so. The two bishops who oversee the United Methodist Church in the state, Marianne Swenson and Beverly J. Shimana, are warning pastors that they could face a church trial and lose their jobs. But the Reverend Janet Golery McKeithen of Santa Monica's Church in Ocean Park told the Times that she plans to conduct weddings for two same-gender couples in August and September. "I love my church and I don't want to leave it," she said. "But I can't be part of a church that is willing to portray a God that is so hateful. I would rather be forced out." The United Methodist Church is the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S. with some 11 million members.
Same-gender couples from Wisconsin who marry in California could also be punished by up to 9 months in jail and a $10,000 fine. That penalty is part of a 1915 law originally enacted to prevent recognition of interracial marriages performed in other states. It could be revived to prosecute Wisconsin gay and lesbian couples who tie the knot in California. Unlike Massachusetts, the only other U.S. state where same-gender marriage is legal, the Golden State has no residency requirement. Wisconsin voters approved a constitutional amendment in 2006 restricting marriage to heterosexual couples. Julaine Appling of the right-wing Wisconsin Family Council told reporters that same-gender couples who break the 1915 law by marrying in California should be punished, calling it a defrauding of the government. But activist Bob Kleba in Madison told the local Capital Times newspaper that he still plans to marry longtime partner David Waugh in California, saying that it would be interesting to be prosecuted.
The Massachusetts Senate has voted to repeal a similar law passed in 1913, also originally designed to ban recognition of interracial marriages performed in other states. It's been used to bar same-gender couples from traveling to Massachusetts to get married if they can't legally wed in their home states. Soon after marriage equality became legal in 2004, then-Republican Governor Mitt Romney, who opposed it, ordered town clerks to enforce the little-known law and deny licenses to lesbi-gay couples from other states. Critics of the statute, including Democrat Deval Patrick, the state's first black governor, say it carries a racist taint and needs to be rescinded. The Senate did just that in a simple voice vote this week. The state's House of Representatives is expected to concur sometime soon. California, which doesn't require residency, is already reaping the financial benefits from same-gender couples who've been traveling to the state to get hitched. An analysis released by the Massachusetts Office of Housing and Economic Development found that repealing the 1913 law and allowing same-gender couples from other states to marry there would add $111 million to the Bay State economy.
Elsewhere, in the first country in the world to open full legal marriage to same-gender couples, Dutch authorities have developed a replacement for maiden name so that gay men who want to take their spouse's surname when they marry won't feel awkward. Geboortenaam translates to birth name. It will replace maiden name on official forms, according to a report this week by Radio Netherlands.
And finally, a court in Sicily has ordered the Italian government to pay 100,000 euros, about 160,000 US dollars, to a man who was issued a disabled driver's license because he's gay. A few years ago, now 27-year-old Danilo Giuffrida told doctors he's gay during a medical examination for the armed forces to escape the 1 year of service that was required at the time, but has since been abolished. The information about Giuffrida, however, was passed on to the Ministry of Defense, which in turn released it to other government agencies, including the Transport Ministry. After he easily passed the driving test to renew his license, examiners told Giuffrida that he'd have to repeat the test or have his license suspended on the grounds of his sexual identity disturbance. After he passed the test a second time, he was told he'd receive only a 1 year renewal as a disabled driver rather than the usual 10 years. Giuffrida then filed his lawsuit. The court ruled that Giuffrida's constitutional rights had been violated and that homosexuality could not be considered a disability. His lawyer said he believed the verdict was the first time the Italian government has been found guilty of discrimination based on sexual orientation. Giuffrida said he'll use some of his lawsuit proceeds to buy a new car.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 19th, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Erica Springer.
And I'm John Beaupre.
Start thinking of what you'd like lesbian humorist Kate Clinton to include on her list of things to do to Dick Cheney later in the program. Does the right to marry solve all the problems of U.S. same-gender couples and other non-traditional families? Feminist law professor Nancy Polakoff says absolutely not in her book Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law. Polakoff discusses her critique of marriage and what the alternatives might be with This Way Out correspondent Josie Cattogio.
Feminists have been critical of the institution of marriage for quite a number of years now. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes,
what is that criticism
about? Yes, and in fact, one of the reasons I wrote this book was because I feel like, unlike you and me, there is at least a generation and maybe more who have grown up without any awareness of the feminist critique of marriage. And so part of what I'm trying to do in this book is reclaim that so that people like the students I teach will see another perspective on marriage. I mean, basically, they have grown up hearing the only criticism of marriage being the exclusion of same-sex couples. So they think that if they support marriage for same-sex couples, they've handled lesbian and gay family issues, and they've handled the problem with marriage. So really, this book is my effort to, you know, reclaim the history, as you say, of the critique of marriage that started in the 19th century with the feminist concerns about the subjugation of women in marriage, and then was quite prominent in second wave feminism in the 1970s in terms of a critique of marriage. But one of the things that's happened is that the law has changed so that we have gender equality in marriage under the law. And I think that makes a lot of people think that the problems have been solved when, of course, they haven't been. I do want to say, though, that when you say, you know, the law has no business in people's private relationships, I'm very sympathetic to that, except that the law all the time decides what relationships matter and what relationships don't matter. So if your partner is killed at work, the law has to decide whether you are going to get survivor's benefits to compensate for the loss of an income to you. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is argue that marriage should never be the dividing line in the law between the relationships that count and those that don't. And I am excited that I found so many examples, individual laws here and there, a patchwork across the country, that I feel like I was able to pull together and say, look, there's one place that gets this right. Let's spread this idea everywhere.
Well, talk about Canada, because Canada really does get it right, and that was a really startling example of the differences.
Yeah, I love to talk about Canada because I think most gay rights activists do know that same-sex couples can marry in Canada, and so they think of Canada as a haven in that regard. But what I like to tell people about is that in Canada, of course, different sex couples were able to marry, and then the next thing that happened in the law was that the law began to treat different sex unmarried couples the same way it treated married couples. In fact, the Canadian Supreme Court has an opinion saying it offends the dignity of its people to require a couple to marry, that it's nothing more than imposing a religious doctrine on people who are entitled to choose not to marry. So they have non-discrimination against unmarried couples, and then same-sex couples were required to be treated in the law like unmarried different sex couples, which essentially gave them virtually all of the rights and obligations of marriage. And then only after that were gay and lesbian couples allowed to marry. So marriage is really a choice for everybody in Canada. If it expresses something about the way you love somebody, if it's a statement that you want to make, well, you can marry, whether you're a straight couple or a gay couple. But nobody has to marry for health insurance, survivor's benefits, pensions, tax benefits, the right to justice if your relationship ends, all the kinds of arguments that same-sex couples make here about why we should have access to marriage. In Canada, they've just removed marriage from the equation of legal rights.
Well, let's talk about children, because people invariably say, well, marriage exists for the protection of children.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate that argument, and I hate it even more when the gay rights movement adapts it to arguing for same-sex marriage. And in the book, I do present some of the worst examples of this. I mean, basically, the right-wing marriage movement, secular and religious, and that's what they call themselves, the marriage movement, they do take the position that the decline of lifelong heterosexual marriage is responsible for all of our social problems. And I mean all of them. Poverty, homelessness, substance abuse, crime, delinquency, infant mortality, illiteracy, chronic illness, you name a problem, this movement is going to attribute it to the decline of lifelong heterosexual marriage. And what they're doing is creating this red herring, this distraction from the urgent social problems we have that cry out for a concerted public response. They're trying to turn it into a private moral failing. If only people would get married and stay married and raise their children in marriages, well, then we wouldn't have these social problems, which is, of course, complete nonsense. But it's got quite a number of adherents in the Bush administration, where $750 million have been allocated for marriage promotion. In my city, we have full-length bus shelter posters that say marriage works and that have brides and grooms on them. This is public money going to private groups to promote marriage. It's an outrage, really.
I know. As a feminist, I'm still utterly shocked that we're allowed to spend money that's supposed to feed children to promote marriage.
And I, you know, would like to see more outrage rather than seeing arguments used by gay couples to say, oh, marriage is so good for children, that's why you should let us marry. Really, those are the arguments that make me the most angry, because since the Supreme Court ruled in 1968 that children born outside marriage have the right to be treated equally with children born to married couples, any stigma that remains, any discrimination that remains between children whose parents are married and those who aren't, that's the problem. The solution isn't to get any more people married. The solution is to stop differentiating based on the marital status of children's parents. And so it makes me very angry when gay rights groups make those arguments.
Feminist law professor and writer Nancy Polakoff continues to go beyond marriage in the conclusion of her conversation with Josie Catoggio.
You can't disinherit your spouse, but you can disinherit your children. Like, how shocking is that? That if you've got some children with a former spouse, you can leave them absolutely nothing in your will, period. But your new spouse, that person you can't disinherit. I mean, it's completely backwards.
Next time on This Way Out.
Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh?
When lesbian feminist humorist Kate Clinton brought her climate change tour to Alexandria, Virginia last November, she served up some choice words for members of the outgoing Bush administration in what she calls a buckshot lunch, despite her attempt at an attitude change.
But I'm trying to be all spiritual. And I'm going along and trying to be where my feet are and trying to be all Om Shanti Boom Boom. And then I am overwhelmed by violent fantasies. I have spent hours thinking about things that I would like to do to Dick Cheney. I'm not proud of it. Oh, Dick Cheney, what a pant load. Old number two, we call him. And now he's head of the fourth branch of government. He's the executive or something. And now apparently we have to call Dick Grandpa. Yes, because his lovely daughter, Mary, she's been busy. She's got a new book out, and it's called Self-Made Man. No, that's not it. It's called, it just sounds like a line from Shirley Temple. Now it's my turn. Oh, when wasn't it your turn, white girl? So she and her lovely partner, Heather, had a baby, and Dick and his lovely wife, Lon Cheney. She's scary, that's all I'm saying. They went to visit the baby, and apparently they brought some lovely gifts. They brought a tiny water board, and oh, you're going to love the next one. And a starter BB gun kit. That story still kills me. The thing that bugged me was all his little pals were like, he's a great hunter. I'm like, he shot his friend in the face. Oh, he's a wonderful hunter. Okay. And then Dick said, I love that one line. He said, well, I just had a beer at lunch with Mel Gibson. Okay. So he's a great hunter. He's a great hunter. So he shoots his friend in the face, and then he does what all good hunters do. He ate him. And then what he didn't finish, he shared with the village. You see, a lovely hunter. I laughed when I wrote it. So now apparently the little baby is talking, and it sounds like this. But then I'm trying to be, you know, trying to be cool, trying to be calm, trying to be kind of spiritual. You got it? I'll just be walking along, having a nice day, being where my feet are, and suddenly I have these raging resentments, generally about the war. But why is it that people who were for the war and changed their mind and now are against the war have more street credibility than I do, who was against the war from the beginning? Can you tell me that? I love those people who say, well, if I knew then what I know now. What exactly did you need to know? And then all summer long, we were waiting for the Petraeus report. Oh, I don't know about you, but I was on pins and needles. Whatever is he going to say? And we're going to listen to Petraeus, who 2 years ago when he was there, he lost 110,000 AK-47s. Oops, clerical error. No, let's listen to him. Basically, the report was there was some good news and some bad news. The good news is that many Iraqis are not being killed because they're already dead or they've left the country. The bad news was that apparently the Iraqi parliament is not reaching political benchmarks. Please, our Congress is not reaching political benchmarks. And they have water and air conditioning and snacks. I'm telling you, Iraq is crack and he's on it. And it's hard to talk to people about it. I was on a plane, what are the chances? And I was circling Newark for about 4 hours. And I'm sitting next to this really big guy, because somewhere in my ticket dossier it says, sit her next to a really big guy who thinks the armrest is his. And we got talking, and we started talking about the war. Oh, my God. It was unbelievable. And he was all jonesing for the war. He had a big war boner going on.
He's like, I'll tell you what we got to do. Here's what we got to do. We got to keep this surge thing going. We got to get more boots on the ground. We got to get some 508s in there and blah, blah, blah. We were just watching his lips move.
And finally I said to him, you know what? Stop. I'm for peace. I'm against this war. And he said to me, well, little lady. I said, thank you so much. Because a lot of times on planes I get sirred. You know, because I just see short hair on the top. Will you have, sir? I always remember what Leah Delaria once said. When somebody said, will you have, sir? She said, a vagina. But he said, well, little lady, why do you hate your country so much? I was like, I don't hate my country. I love my country. I hate what's happening. And he was all like, well, what would you do? What would you do? What's your plan? And I thought, finally, someone is asking me what I would do. And I said, well, I'll tell you what I would do. I would go into Iraq and I would build malls. I would make that green zone into the mall of Iraq. I'd let them buy electronic equipment, iPhones, I don't care. Get them basic cable. Let them buy clothes, pastels, who cares? I mean, it's totally pacified us. It could work there. Now, for those of us who live above ground, we know it's not going well in Iraq, because now they're talking about getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now they're all like, oh, we think you guys are great soldiers. We were kidding. Get in the front. And then that Peter Pace, who said that homosexuality is immoral. I thought, oh, good. We're too immoral to fight in an immoral war. Two negatives make a positive. Thank you. Thank you so much. And those old retired military guys, they're all over the cable shows, you know, talking about gays in the military. And they're all like, well, if there are gays in the military, and they always talk through a burp. Why is that? They're all like, well, if they're gay. Incoming. They're gays in the... Could you possibly burp and get back to me? Would that be all right? Well, if there are gays in the military, it'll destroy the military. Excellent. You know, I've always felt that apparently we could have put a flaming queen on a hillside in Iraq going, hello, and it would have been over and not a shot fired.
Kate Clinton's latest comedy CD is called Climate Change. For more information, log on to kateclinton.com. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Erica Springer, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Josie Catoggio contributed program material. You heard a cut from Kate Clinton's Climate Change CD. Donald O'Connor sang Make 'em Laugh, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WFCS New Britain, Connecticut, KUOI Moscow, Idaho, CFRC Kingston, Ontario, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. In our top spin, Las Vegas television viewers are getting extra advertising with their morning news. Local Fox station KVVU signed a product placement deal with McDonald's. Now, cups of iced coffee sit in front of its morning anchors. No one will say how much the fast food giant paid the station for the six-month deal. KVVU's news director said the deal will not affect his station's reporting, but the marketing firm that negotiated the deal said the station needs to let them know if it plans to air a negative story on McDonald's. McDonald's has similar deals with stations in Chicago, Seattle, and New York City. A growing number of morning TV news shows are seeking product placement deals.
It was a rally to stop the war on the poor. But speakers supported drilling for oil in Alaska, and protesters carried signs that read, "Environmental groups don't feed my family." Three groups organized the Washington, D.C. rally, including Americans for American Energy, a front group funded by a public relations firm that works for pro-drilling interests. The Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, was also involved. CORE is a former civil rights group that's received funding from ExxonMobil. A CORE spokesperson said his group wants greater domestic oil production so that energy costs will decrease. One person at the rally admitted to a reporter that she was only there because her boss told her to attend.
If you haven't seen or heard an ad about the U.S. presidential election yet, you're not paying attention. Independent advocacy groups are increasingly running their own ads. Many feature veterans speaking about foreign policy issues. The conservative pro-war group Vets for Freedom has already spent $1.5 million on advertising and plans to spend much more. This ad, featuring Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, is critical of Democratic candidate Barack Obama.
Some in Washington told us the war was lost.
Others said the surge would fail.
But while they argued,
we continued to fight.
Today, even the harshest critics agree. The surge worked.
The surge worked.
Al-Qaeda has been decimated, and the Iraqi government grows stronger each day.
These are the facts.
They cannot be denied.
While some may not like this war,
those who fought it
know we can't afford to lose.
We need to finish the job.
We need to finish the job.
No matter who is president.
The AFL-CIO labor union is also running ads featuring veterans. In one, a Vietnam veteran expresses respect for Republican candidate John McCain's war record while questioning his plan to continue the occupation of Iraq.
Are airline ticket prices complicating your summer plans? If so, you should blame oil speculators, says the airline industry. An industry trade group, the Air Transport Association of America, or ATA, recently launched a campaign called Stop Oil Speculation. As part of the campaign, 12 major airlines sent emails to their frequent flyers, urging them to contact members of Congress. An ATA executive said, quote, "We're not asking our customers to help us. We're asking them to help themselves," end quote. ATA says that nearly 1 million emails were sent to Congress in the first 2 days of the campaign. One ATA member, Delta Airlines, is so concerned with high fuel prices that it recently offered free helicopter rides to select New York customers.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned the front group Americans for American Energy. The pro-drilling group is funded by the public relations firm PacWest Communications. For years, PacWest has supported drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's also opposed many environmental protections. Last year, the firm hired former U.S. House Resources Committee Chair Richard Pombo. While in Congress, Pombo wrote legislation that environmental groups said would have gutted the Endangered Species Act. The bill would have removed habitat protections and required the government to pay property owners unable to develop their land. The Save Our Species Alliance, which was headed by a PacWest executive, worked to increase support for Pombo's bill. The bill didn't pass, but another PacWest-linked effort was more successful. The front group Project Protect advocated for the Bush administration's Healthy Forests Plan.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
This is the Corporate Watchdog Radio Viewpoint, a weekly commentary from sustainability experts. This week, we hear from Stacey Malkin, co-founder of the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, commenting on toxics in cosmetics. Malkin points out that companies are allowed to label products natural or organic and still use harmful synthetics. Her award-winning book, Not Just a Pretty Face, The Ugly Side of the Beauty Industry, tells the inside story of the campaign's five-year effort to hold the beauty industry accountable to women's health.
How many personal care products did you use on your body today? Shampoo, deodorant, lotion, hair gel? We all use these products, and some of us are even obsessed with them. As I confess in my book, I was a 17 magazine reading makeup diva desperate to fit in. The Osco drug cosmetics aisle was my comfort zone. I loved my beauty products. I trusted them, and I used lots of them. About 20 products a day, all topped off with an enormous cloud of Aquanet Extra Super Hold hairspray in the big pink metal can. Recently, I looked up these products from my former teen routine in the Skin Deep database, and I was surprised to discover that I had been exposing myself to 230 synthetic chemicals a day before even getting on the school bus. So what's in this stuff that we rub on our bodies on a daily basis? The Campaign for Safe Cosmetics has been researching that question for the past 5 years, and we've uncovered the ugly truth about the beauty industry. Carcinogens in baby shampoo, lead in lipstick, hormone-disrupting chemicals in fragrance and aftershave, these are just some of the toxic surprises lurking in everyday products. Disturbingly, many body products are made with hazardous petrochemicals linked to cancer, infertility, learning disabilities, and other health problems that are becoming epidemic. In just my lifetime, the risk of getting breast cancer has nearly tripled in the United States. One in two American men and one in three women will get some type of cancer in our lifetimes. We obviously need to reduce carcinogens in the environment and in our homes, starting with the products we use on our bodies. The good news is companies already know how to make baby shampoo without carcinogens and lipstick without lead. So why do some products still contain these unnecessary toxins? In short, because it's cheaper and because they can. Companies are allowed to put nearly any chemical into personal care products sold in the U.S. with no required safety testing. The European Union bans 1,100 chemicals from personal care products because of concerns about cancer and reproductive harm. The U.S. bans only 10. Even products labeled natural or organic may contain harmful synthetics, since the U.S. has no legal standards for personal care products. It's time to make American products as safe as they can be. You can help give the beauty industry a makeover by taking two actions today. First, shop smart. You can find safer products on the Environmental Working Group's Skin Deep database at www.safecosmetics.org. Secondly, we need to pass new laws that require companies to use safe ingredients. Visit us at safecosmetics.org to learn how you can get involved so that all of us, even the makeup divas, can buy any product and know that it's safe for our families and our health. For the Corporate Watchdog Report commentaries from Ben, I'm Stacey Malkin from the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics and author of the new book, Not Just a Pretty Face, The Ugly Side of the Beauty Industry.
You can find a link to the campaign's website at corporatewatchdogradio.org.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Teamsters Local 705 in Chicago, second largest in the nation, has authorized a strike against UPS with a deadline of midnight, July 31st. Job security and working conditions are among the issues. Joe Baucus is a Teamsters Local 705 worker.
The companies are keep on getting richer and the working class are keep on getting poorer. Enough is enough. It's time we draw a line in the sand. We can't take it anymore. The starting pay has only been increased once since I've been working here for 20 years. We deserve better. Paying people $8.50 to $9.50 an hour to start is immoral.
Juan Campos is recording secretary for Local 705.
This is a company that's made, since 1997 to today, over $20 billion profit. This is not a company that's crying for money that, or needs money or needs flexibility or needs concessions.
A lawsuit by Chicago's Working Hands Legal Clinic on behalf of immigrant workers at O'Hare Airport accuses United Airlines and several other companies of illegally profiting from wholesale violations of state and federal labor law. Attorney Jed Unterrecker says the companies profited from illegal exploitation of these workers by using the temp agency Ideal Staffing Solutions to bring the workers in.
We hope this case sends a message to all employers, particularly those using temporary staffing workers, that if they try to shield themselves from their responsibilities, if they try to hide behind temporary staffing companies and their workers, that they will be caught, and they still have obligations, and temporary workers still have rights too.
The suit names United, Alitalia, Singapore Airlines, Gate Gourmet, Air Menzies International, Swissport Cargo Services, J.D. Norman Industries, Apex Plastic Finishing Company, and Ideal Staffing Solutions. According to their attorneys, the temporary staffing workers are owed thousands of hours in unpaid wages and overtime. The United Mine Workers of America has endorsed a single-payer universal national health care system for the U.S. The Mine Workers Union has joined more than 440 other labor organizations in backing the bill sponsored by Representative John Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan. UMWA President Cecil Roberts.
When George Bush gets sick, now who pays for that? Oh, come on, who pays for that? When old Dick Cheney gets sick, who pays for that? When Condoleezza Rice gets sick, who pays for that? When Clarence Thomas gets sick, who pays for that? I submit to you, whatever they got, when we're out there knocking on doors, we just simply say, we want what they got and we'll be happy.
The nation's largest mall, Minnesota's Mall of America, now has one of the country's first organized Starbucks coffee shops. Workers there are members of the Industrial Workers of the World. On Monday, they stopped work to protest the closing of 600 stores nationwide and the loss of more than 12,000 jobs. The IWW also represents workers in New York City and Chicago. WINS Labor News is now available right on your cell phone. Just dial 425-527-7001. Get your WINS Labor News on your cell phone at 425-527-7001. Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Peak Oil Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
Earlier this month, on the 39th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11, the first spacecraft to carry humans to the surface of the moon, Al Gore proposed a challenge at least as bold as John F. Kennedy's 1961 challenge to land a man on the moon and bring him back safely by the end of the decade. Gore proposed that the United States commit to generating 100% of its electricity renewably and from what he called truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years. He touted a combination of wind and solar for U.S. electricity needs. Regardless of whether 100% renewable electricity is achievable within 10 years, Gore's challenge is a sort of bold goal that we need at a time when business as usual is leading us off a cliff, economically, environmentally, and security-wise. For me, Gore's challenge is also an excuse to revisit comments I made at the beginning of this year about the possibilities of substituting electricity for oil. At the time, oil had just closed at $100 a barrel for the first time. How much can electricity substitute for oil? There are limits, partly because oil is an energy-dense liquid fuel. You can pour it in your gas tank and carry large amounts of energy, long distances. Batteries don't store as much energy in a given weight or a tank size. Your house's oil tank can be filled in the summer and store that oil until cold weather sets in with virtually no loss. Batteries won't do that, either. Yet electricity can replace some uses of oil. For now, let's adopt Al Gore's bold vision and imagine 100% renewable generation of electricity within 10 years. Further, let's pretend that we can wave a magic wand and make that supply of electricity unlimited. Given an unlimited supply of electricity, how could we use it to substitute for oil? Only a tiny percentage of electricity in the U.S. is generated using oil, so there is little to be gained by replacing the oil with other fuels. Transportation. Now that's where the big oil uses are in the United States. Cars, trucks, buses, and airplanes account for 2/3 of U.S. oil consumption. Cars are the single biggest users, guzzling about 25% of all the oil we use. Plug-in hybrid cars could replace most of their gas use with electricity. Plug-in hybrids charge their batteries from the electric grid. For shorter trips, the batteries and an electric motor are all that's needed. For longer trips, a gas tank and gasoline engine provide the extra range. For many users, almost all daily trips could be within the range of the batteries, dropping gasoline use to nearly nothing. Other options are completely battery-driven cars or cars that run on hydrogen made with electricity from water. All this would take time. Even for technologies that have been successfully demonstrated, like electric cars, it takes time to gear up factories and begin production. Even if all the new cars and light trucks purchased from today onward were plug-in hybrids, it would still take 10 to 15 years to replace half the existing fleet at the rate people buy new vehicles. And, as world oil production declines, the economy is wobbling. In hard economic times, people tend to hold on to what they have rather than buying replacements, so the turnover time is becoming even longer. That's probably why Gore advocates subsidizing car companies to produce and sell plug-in hybrids. Electrifying buses, trolleys, and trains is also possible. These, too, take time and money. In sum, there's only room for marginal short-term replacement of oil with electricity. 2/3 of U.S. oil use is for transportation, and it would take a couple decades to retool our vehicles and our rails so that large amounts of electricity could power cars, buses, and trains. To be fair, Gore's proposal is focused primarily on phasing out coal by the end of the decade, and that would have a tremendous effect in reducing U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases. At a time when world oil exports are dropping, and projected to continue to drop, renewable electricity is not much of a solution for reducing oil dependence. A lot more reduction in oil use will probably come from simply less moving of our bodies and our stuff. As during World War II, people will ask, "Is this trip really necessary?" before going anywhere. We might even discover more of the treasures of our own country and become better friends with our neighbors. I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
I know I've said it before, but this time I mean it. It's my favorite time of the year, sweet corn season. I love sweet corn. The trend lately in corn has shifted from traditional yellow sweet corn, which has an intense corn taste, to white varieties, which are loaded with sugar but not a lot of corn flavor. You can probably tell which I prefer. Unfortunately, it is now getting pretty hard to find yellow sweet corn, so I typically have to settle for bicolor. Anytime I do see a farmer selling yellow corn, I thank them profusely in hopes they keep it up. Like sweet peas, corn begins converting sugar to starch immediately after picking, so it is in the best interest of your taste buds to purchase it as close to having been picked as possible and eating it shortly thereafter. I believe the traditional country wisdom for consuming corn is that you place the water on to boil and then go outside to pick and shuck the ears of corn. By the time you return to the kitchen with your corn in tow, your water will be boiling and ready. Contrary to what my dear mother will tell you, sweet corn does not require a long cooking time, only about 5 minutes in rapidly boiling water. Sweet corn, of course, is a perfect pair with butter and salt, but if you are cutting it from the cob, there are really endless options. And here's a tip for you. If you dip the ears in boiling water for a minute, the kernels will be much easier to remove and won't go flying around your kitchen. A sharp knife never hurt anyone either. I like to combine corn with crispy chunks of bacon, scallions, and just a pinch of cream. You can stir sweet corn into polenta or risotto or bake it into cornbread.
Corn is wonderful on the grill. I like to husk it first so I get a nice caramelization in the kernels, although there are many camps telling you to grill it in the husk after a quick soak to prevent burning. Sweet corn freezes beautifully. If you have a vacuum food preserving system such as a food saver, I love to package a few servings of sweet corn with salt, pepper, and a pat of butter. In January, just put the bag in a pot of boiling water for 15 minutes and cut it open. It's like a tiny little vacation for your mouth. If you are in need of yet another reason to kick that stupid low-carb diet to the curb, here's one. Sweet corn is very good for you. It's a good source of B vitamins, fiber, and vitamin C. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS LPFM 102.1 and 98.3 Columbus Community Radio.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
So we have a great lineup coming up next hour, so I won't have time to bring you all of the funny stylings of Scooter and his Innerside Radio show next hour. However, I do have time for about 10 minutes of his show until the top of the hour right now. So here's a segment from Scooter.
79% of Americans think that Jesus is going to come down out of the clouds and rectify all of our problems with his magic powers at some point in history. 20% of Americans claim to be certain that it will happen in their lifetime. This is precisely the sort of thinking we do not need. And I think it should be rather obvious that prophecies about the end of the world could well be self-fulfilling. So in the uniqueness of our circumstance with respect to the growth of technology, I think also shouldn't be ignored. I mean, not only is technology growing, but the rate at which technology is growing is also growing. I mean, futurists like Ray Kurzweil have said that the rate is doubling every 10 years. So that if you look at the rate at which technology was growing in the year 2000 as your metric, the 20th century represents something like 20 years of change. Now we're in the process of making another 20 years of change in about 14 years, and then 7, and then 3.5. If this trend continues, the 21st century won't represent 100 years of technological change, but 20,000 years. I mean, 20,000 years ago, human beings exactly like ourselves, with the same size brains, the same biological capacity for creative thought, had been languishing for at least 100,000 years and had produced nothing more complicated than a bow and arrow. We went from a bow and arrow to the internet in 20,000 years. Imagine seeing this much change in a single century. And let's be utterly conservative. Let's just say we're going to have as much change in this century as we did last century. Even this is sobering when you recognize who is going to have access to this kind of technology. I mean, just look at how the internet has facilitated the global jihadist movement among Muslims. Look how difficult it is proving to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So I think if we accept that the quite reasonable premise that it's going to remain easier to break things than to fix them or defend them, the growth of technology is quite sobering in the way that it is interacting with religion, especially in a world that has been shattered into competing religious and moral communities, and especially among communities who think death is an illusion, that this world is fit only to be consumed by God's fury, and that the destruction of every tangible good will itself be the highest good because it will be a gateway to eternity. These are explicitly religious ideas. They have no basis in fact, and yet they are amazingly well subscribed. It seems to me that it is everyone's responsibility to help break this spell.
Oh, hello. In your arguments, you use mostly reason and the brain to argue against religion and the Bible. What would you say to people who try to lead a good and just life by through their religion and by following what is in their hearts, rather than following the literal sayings of the Bible and following reasoning?
Yeah, well, I certainly don't mean to diminish experience that has nothing to do with coming to a rational understanding of the way the world works. I mean, much of our experience is not a matter of reason. It's not a matter of belief, even. And some of the most important aspects of our experience aren't. So experiencing love and devotion and awe. I mean, these are features of our subjectivity that I think are extraordinarily valuable. The important thing to recognize is that if you think the only real container, the only viable container for those experiences is your denominational church, is the language of your ancestors, you know, if you're still committed to being a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, I think you are tacitly supporting the religious divisions in our world. I mean, you are giving cover, I think, quite explicitly to all of the people who take their holy books far more seriously. I mean, I can't tell you how much time I and other people have spent having to fight the battle against the liberals and moderate Christians and Jews and Muslims insist upon the viability of these denominations and of raising their children to think that they're Christians and Muslims and Jews, who will never admit that any of the extremist behavior going on in the name of their faith has anything to do with religion. And so it there's no question in my mind that it provides a kind of friction in our discourse where we really can't call a spade and say, okay, this is much of the Bible and the Quran is just life-destroying gibberish, and we just have to acknowledge this and cease to take these books seriously.
First of all, I loved your first book. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
Stunned at how young you are, because...
Don't be stunned. I'm not that young.
Yeah. Well, in learning, I mean, I thank you so much for taking the time to study Western and Eastern religions for decades. That's why I thought you were older.
Uh-huh.
But my question has to do more with where our beliefs come from. We know there's a lot of peer pressure in our culture to be religious, to have a belief in God, and to be a part of some organized religion. And I have tried my whole life to be a part of that in terms of, I've tried three different religions. I've converted twice. And that thing doesn't work for me. The God thing does not work for me. And I've always felt very unhappy about it, that it was a lack somehow in my character. But then I've read recently that there's a study that has been done, and I'm wondering if maybe this is why you're studying neuroscience. There's a study that has been done that posits there may be a belief gene, there may be a gene in people that makes them believers, and those of us who don't have it, we don't have it.
Right, right. Well, I think you might be referring to Dean Hamer's much publicized notion of the God gene, which...
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, related to a serotonin receptor or transporter that people have in abundance, that they tend to have these transcendent experiences. So it didn't deal with belief per se. I think that the issue of belief is that I don't see religious belief as distinct from any other kinds of beliefs. I mean, we represent the world in our thoughts, and all of us are in the business of hoping that our representations are accurate, or at least accurate enough so that we can successfully negotiate our lives happily. I mean, nobody wants to be mistaken, profoundly mistaken, about their place in the world, about what, you know, what happens after death, or where their loved ones go after. I mean, we're not in the business of deceiving ourselves just willfully. And so religious beliefs are on all fours with all of our other beliefs. We are describing the world. We're trading in these descriptions through language. Someone says to you, well, do you realize that Jesus is your personal savior and you know, nobody, you know, he's the way and the truth and the life, and nobody gets to heaven but through him? That is a description of the way this universe is organized in moral terms and in spiritual terms. And it's either right or wrong, and it purports to be right. Reason and belief are not easily
separated. And that was Sam Harris, a major figure in the New Atheist movement. The Inner Side Radio program is not an expression of the speakers heard within. Mr. Harris, as well as Christopher Hitchens and other spokespersons for the New Atheist, are documented critics of the Islamic 11th century cultural retardation and the violent impulses within a religious doctrine which might spawn suicide bombings or the attack on the Twin Towers in New York City. Frankly, I couldn't smell the Twin Towers destruction from my house. And 2,200 people dying in a global conflict over resources is about as important as paper or plastic in a Kroger checkout line to me. What astounds me about the intellectual claptrap and the alleged Western Enlightenment is their lack of evidence as how the Islamic threat is, frankly, an Islamic threat. All of the evidence points to the West betraying and raping the Middle East, the same way the same forces raped and destroyed West Virginia and the Congo and the Native Americans. The enlightened Western forces, be it the United States murdering 500,000 in Iraq, or the enlightened modernist Jews with their petulant little Warsaw ghetto in Palestine getting a free ride while Sam and Hitchens sell us the fear of the sinister Islam. I'm sorry, I am not impressed. Do not confuse the new atheist movement with a progressive impulse. They are as ethnocentric and jingoistic as their Western spawn. My name is Scooter. This has been the Inner Side Radio Program, reminding you once again that nationalism will make you way more stupid than religion.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau. Free people, free radio.